Hey, if I was to put you on the spot and ask you to explain the word ecosystem, what would you say?
Ecosystem is like nature.
I think it's where all the plants like meet together, like mushrooms and stuff.
I think maybe going step by step to help nature or something.
Or to help the planet from like global warming.
To take care of our planet and stuff like that.
All like the whole world's climate and nature system, I think.
Like kind of like a water system, like how it would all flow and stuff.
Yeah, I think an ecosystem is everything talking to each other and pollution getting less and less better.
Like if one gets extinct, maybe if all the rats die, then cats won't have that much to eat in the wild.
I mean, there's a lot in that name, but if you really had to refine your answer...
An ecosystem is basically a connection between all the animals.
It's like a balanced world.
For example, like, do you know The Lion King, the circle of life? When, for example, the lion dies, it turns into like the soil of the grass, and then when the antelopes eat the grass, and then when the lions eat the antelopes, and blah, blah, blah.
Where life thrives and there's a food chain and a sustainable water source and that stuff.
Okay, so... An ecosystem is a structured system that includes all the living organisms in an area and the environment around them, all working together as a functional unit?
All the animals and the plants working together.
To me, it's kind of like how everything depends on itself, kind of like a building. So if you take one column out, then it will collapse.
But where are my manners? Asking so many questions without an introduction. I'm Evie Kenny. And today on Ecolution, we're talking about engineering? Yeah, I know. Nikki, I'm confused.
Just go with it, Evie.
If you insist. Today we are going to discuss one of the most influential builders of the natural world. And to do so, we're going to speak with an eco-hydrologist. A what? Wait, what even is that?
I think an eco-hydrologist.
I'm just guessing that is someone who helps animals.
Maybe like a person that tells the weather.
Maybe it's someone who looks after all the nature and wildlife.
Of plants and animals.
A person that studies animals, which I think that I want to be when I grow up.
And maybe it makes music in caves with an echo, maybe.
They study the water.
It studies underwater life and the food chain and water itself.
An eco-hydrologist is a person who studies both ecology, that's where the eco comes from, and hydrology, which is water. So an eco-hydrologist specifically, like me, is focusing on how living things, plants, animals, etc., influence water, how it moves, where it's stored, and how much of it we have.
Aha! Finally, it's starting to make sense. Let's welcome today's guest.
My name is Emily Fairfax, and I'm an assistant professor at the University of Minnesota. I'm also an eco-hydrologist, and all of my research is studying beavers. From day to day, that could mean logging onto my computer and doing satellite analyses with data from space, or it could mean going out into the field and wading hip-deep through a beaver pond to try to figure out if they're there or not.
I love beavers. I mean, we don't have them here, but in America, where Emily works, they have a lot to keep track of.
Pretty much everywhere in North America, we are studying beavers, and I feel very fortunate to be able to go visit all these places in person. What's really cool about my research, though, is I don't have to go somewhere in person to visit it because I do so much work with satellites. So I can use these things flying around in the sky that are taking pictures every single place on the Earth every single day, and I can see the beavers everywhere.
I can't say that I've seen one in real life, but I get the motivation to want to help the nature we see around us. But how do you begin to make that your job?
I was an engineer working on metals, and so I didn't like that job a whole lot, and I felt kind of sad about it. And I happened to be watching TV, and a documentary called Leave It to Beavers came on. And I was absolutely hooked, because this was the first time in my life I had in front of me images of all of these different scientists at wetlands telling me this isn't solved. There's still questions about beavers. Look at how important they are as we deal with droughts. Like, who's going to study this? And at first I was thinking to myself, well, this can't be true. Beavers must be solved. This animal's been around for so long. But I tried to figure it out. I looked up the questions they were posing and none of them had papers about them. It was truly open science. And that made me decide to quit my job and go to graduate school to study beavers. And that brought me into earth science and geology programs, where water is what you're studying, and then how the water moves is the focus. The beavers are kind of secondary. It was the right path in, although every year I've been on this path, it's drifted more and more and more towards the beavers themselves. So you never stop learning.
Every day is a learning day on Ecolution. But what do you know about beavers?
I keep thinking about a platypus. I can't think about a beaver.
They're cute.
Well, beavers are, I think, mammals that live in the wild with webbed feet for swimming and a tail for slapping the water when a danger comes.
It might help the environment.
A beaver is a thing that eats logs. It likes to build dams. And also we can't understand them.
So it can build like a dam, which is their home that they can have babies and live.
They have big teeth.
And they also gnaw on wood so their teeth don't go through the bottom of their jaw.
They like chewing.
I think they cut down the trees with their teeth.
And then when it falls over, it lands in the river. So then they keep doing that and maybe get sticks and wood and then keep building, and then it kind of makes a big hump of sticks and mud.
Beavers are nature's engineers, and they are an ecosystem engineer, which means that they are an animal that can go out and change the physical earth to better suit their needs. There's actually not a lot of animals that can do this in a big way. And when it comes to being an ecosystem engineer, beavers are the second most powerful on the planet, second only to us, people. We are also an ecosystem engineer. What makes beavers really special, though, is that in addition to being an ecosystem engineer, they're also a keystone species. And what that means is that when they make all of these changes to make their favorite habitat, which is a wetland, a byproduct of that is they have created an environment that is perfect for so many other different things.
So, like, in the movie, it said that if there's, like, one beaver, if they bring back one beaver, then more animals will come. That's what it said in the movie.
They built a dam which it can create each lake, which lets loads of life form in the lake.
Dams to form ponds, and the ponds can live fish, toads, and let the toads reproduce, so are the fish, and also gives other animals drinking and wolves to hunt stuff.
And at least here in the United States, about 80% of our land-based animals need access to a healthy streamside ecosystem or wetland ecosystem at some point in their life cycle. Humans have destroyed somewhere between 50 and 90% of the wetlands in North America. Beavers are out there rebuilding them, and it's making them just extraordinarily important for supporting a lot of other plants and animals.
Wow. Now I wish we did have beavers here. It seems our brain trust and Step Aside ETNS know a whole lot about them. And in the past few months, people have learned a lot more by flocking to the cinema to see a film that focuses on these dam-building geniuses. Pixar's latest, Hoppers.
We've done it, Mabel. After years of work, this revolutionary technology gives us unprecedented access to the animal world.
I was actually the recipient of a cold email from Pixar when it came to Hoppers. So I had just given a talk at a webinar for beavers in California, and I was talking about beavers and climate change and wildfire and how they can be a partner in dealing with what I consider to be the biggest struggle of our generation. And the organizer of that conference emailed me afterwards, and she was like, hey, there were some Pixar people in the audience. Isn't that cool? And I was like, that is really cool. But I didn't think anything of it because Pixar is based in California, and I was talking about California. Like, they're allowed to learn about their state. But then a couple of months later, I had an email in my inbox from Pixar. It's like, hello, could you give a talk to our employees about your research? Also, here's a 200-page non-disclosure agreement. Don't tell anyone about this. I was like, whoa, this must be fake. But it wasn't fake. And I was like, well, I'll respond to it anyways, and I'll know by the response if it's fake or not. And I responded, I was like, sure, I'd love to. And then I get like a Zoom link from the Pixar account and clear directions about what they would like me to talk about. And I log on, and there's Pixar. There's the writers and directors, and they want to learn about beavers. And I gave the talk, and that was kind of the end of it. And I thought, all right, well, that was interesting. There must be like a side character in something, or they're doing landscape research. I don't know. And then I had an email for another talk with different questions. And we did that, and then another talk, and then another talk. And then an ask, hey, could you take our art team out into your field sites for like a week and show them the beaver ponds? And I still don't actually know what it's for at this point. And I'm just like, sure, I'll haul around 15 artists in the field. That's fine. And I did that. And I took them to all my places, got to know all these artists, knew that beavers were important at this point, but still didn't know why. And it was only after that trip, I think I proved myself trustworthy enough, that I got an email asking if I could watch a version of the movie and provide scientific feedback on it.
Whoa.
Hey.
How you doing, girl?
Are we vibing?
Hey, big boy.
What's up?
I understand you.
And so I got a copy of it and I watched it and I'm taking notes. And then I go to Pixar's campus to talk about what I saw, what was scientifically accurate, what was not. And then importantly, does it matter? Because they're not making a documentary. They're making a fun movie. So what parts of science matter to get right? And what parts can you kind of do movie magic with? And I did a few iterations of that. All in all, I worked with them for 5 years. It was wild.
Uh-huh.
The film focuses on a young woman called Mabel, who is passionate about the pond where she lives. One that's been created by beavers. And so she works hard to make sure they are valued. Emily acted as a key consultant on the film. And I'll admit, the more you speak to Emily Fairfax, the more you could imagine they based Mabel on her.
It wasn't explicit if they did. Whoa. I know that the team spent a lot of time with me and was subjected to many of my impassioned rants about beavers and frustrations with how we treat them. I think they saw some of that energy and then melded it with this greater youth environmental movement.
Yeah, I guess that's true. But,
While Hoppers is a snapshot of one adventure in the life of some beavers and the creatures they live alongside, I was keen to know what the average day in the life was for these helpful rodents.
Day in the life of the beaver is generally going to have a routine, but you can get knocked out of routine for a few different reasons. The standard routine, beavers are going to wake up. It is most often said that beavers are crepuscular, meaning that they are most active at dawn and at dusk and around those hours. However, beavers are very capable of changing their waking hours to suit their needs in their specific place. So there are beavers that I visit that I call the daytime beavers, and they are out normal business hours with me. There are beavers that are solidly nighttime beavers, and family to family, that decision is being made. So beaver wakes up, whatever time of day or night that happens to be, to start its day. And the first thing I see them do is what I call a perimeter check. So they are going to go out and start swimming around the edge of their entire wetland complex. And this is somewhere between 1 and 2 kilometers of stream length. It's a large area. They're checking for leaks. They're checking for signs that there's weird stranger beavers trying to move in. They're checking for predators. They just want to get a lay of the land. Once they've done that, assuming everything is all right, then they start all of their business. And that is going to be patching leaks on the dam, expanding some of the dams, gathering a bunch of food, wrestling. They spend a huge amount of time grooming each other, eating, playing. A lot of people don't realize this, but beavers get the zoomies. And so they'll just like have a lot of energy all of a sudden and want to go chomping around chaotically. We've seen them jump off of trees and riverbanks like little cannonballs into the water. They're very playful. They also have very interesting family dynamics. So if you're mom beaver or dad beaver, you might have slightly different daily responsibilities than the teenage beavers, who have different responsibilities than the little babies called kits. A lot of times we'll see the teenagers sort of chaperoning the kits while mom and dad are seriously trying to work. But then later we'll see mom or dad taking one of the little kits around and showing them how to build a dam. And they just go about doing this on repeat, build, play, groom, eat, resume, zoom, over and over until it's time for them to go to bed. And then they'll do a little perimeter check right before they go to bed, make sure everything's all right, head into the lodge, form a giant snuggle pile, and go to sleep.
I mean, that sounds adorable. Pixar has a track record for creating cute characters, but it's incredible to see just how true to the science so many parts of the film really are.
Yeah, they really wanted to do a good job with it. They put a lot of time and effort into fact-finding, and they got all the feedback from me. And at times, I almost felt a little rude because I would see a really beautiful scene that they had come up with and all these characters that are in it. And I'd say, well, you know, that bird wouldn't be here. That's not a bird that would visit a wetland. And they already had this gorgeous character design. And a lot of times it would change. And the next time I saw it, it would be just a little more scientifically accurate. It would be a little more clear. My favorite thing that they were very receptive to feedback on was the beavers had to be fatter. And the first time that they made the beaver, it was this really slender looking animal and it looked like an otter. And I was like, no, this is like these animals are much fatter. And my next talk that I gave had just picture after picture of these really chunky beavers. And then they made them a little fatter and a little fatter. And it almost became a joke. And I sat in on one of their character tests where one of the animators was showing the most recent design of one of the beavers. And before I could even open my mouth, someone else on the team said, no, 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 this needs to be fatter. Add more rolls. And I was like, oh, good. Wonderful. Because they are. And there's like nothing. The fact that they're these bowling ball animals is to their advantage. And it mattered to me that they weren't represented like otters because so many people mistake them for otters.
When I think of beavers, I think of their wide tails, their choppers. But besides that, the enormous dams they build. If only I knew an eco-hydrologist who could explain why.
We think that beavers first learned to build dams because it allowed them to survive in environments that didn't have continuous open water that stayed liquid. So they were up really far north into the Arctic back during the Miocene. And this was millions and millions of years ago. It was basically a jungle back then. So they're up there, they're doing their thing, climate changes, and suddenly the Arctic is getting extremely cold. Most of the big mammals either had to move quickly south or they died. Beavers are not known for their speed, and so they were up there being stressed by the environment. They already knew how to cut trees, and so at some point that tree cutting turned into piling up the sticks and creating deeper pools. These deeper pools don't freeze through in the winter. And so that was the key to their survival, was it was enough liquid water held back at enough depth to stay open so they could keep eating food that they were storing underwater, even when everything else was under snow and ice. Then, as time goes on, this behavior is reinforced. They become dam builders. They start to control their environment more. And that's where we think the sort of next reason for dam building really took off, which is safety. Beavers are awkward animals. They are anywhere from 40 to 110 pounds as an adult, body shaped like a bowling ball, hands on the front, webbed feet on the back, and then a big paddle tail coming out of their rump. So it's not built for overland travel. Beavers cannot run. You get secondhand embarrassment watching them try to run. It's really not good. But they're really good swimmers. And so then there's this natural extension of dam building. Well, if I can increase the water area, then I have a larger area that I'm safe. And what's really fascinating is there's another ecosystem engineering behavior beavers have that is less obvious, but I think even more important for their survival and for their ability to change the landscape, which is they dig canals. So once you have those ponds, beavers are then going to go excavate and dig out these little tiny micro streams. They just dig them with their paws, move mud, and it winds up creating basically a highway system of water. And that's how the beavers get around. And they can outswim any predator, and they've increased their safety area. They've also massively increased their area of influence on the land.
When I imagine the land that beavers thrive on, I think of trees, ducks, and countryside. But what are beavers actually drawn towards?
That's a great question. The things that beavers are drawn to is not necessarily the same things that create a condition in which beavers can thrive. Sometimes we think beavers are pretty precious and they need to have really specific conditions, like the slope of your stream needs to be not that steep and you have to have willows or alders or cottonwoods or birch or aspen or one of their favorite tree foods around. You have to have sort of clayey soils, but not too clayey because that's what they like to dig in. There's just these laundry lists of beavers' preferences. And then every single day you go in the field, you find beavers breaking the rules. And we'll find beavers just hauling themselves up incredibly steep river gorges, straight up, not even taking switchbacks, to go get their favorite food and bypassing a food that's also acceptable, but they just didn't want to eat it. We have beavers in downtown San Jose, which is in the Bay Area of California, extraordinary urban metropolis. They're building on a creek that is basically a concrete channel, and their dams are made of mud, trash, and occasional reeds. And they're thriving. They're doing great. They've made it work for themselves. Beavers are extraordinarily robust. The number one thing I think beavers need to thrive is acceptance from the people around them, because we're pretty much the only thing that can permanently deter a beaver from coming to a space.
Sadly, beavers don't seem to have ever been native to Ireland, although they were once prevalent across the UK, our closest island neighbour. After pilot schemes in sheltered areas, beavers are now being actively reintroduced across the UK, with wild beavers now numbering almost 3,000, and they are making great strides in helping correct water courses, wherever they are. Which is great for nature, but not always welcomed by humans. Which is a tale that's similar in the US.
People are mixed about if they want beavers back in abundance in North America. I think you'll find that nobody wants them to be completely eradicated. Everybody understands that this is an important animal in North American landscapes, but a lot of people are like, great, but not in my backyard. I don't want it there. I want it somewhere else. And that has been a challenge, but it is changing. And unfortunately, I think that it's changing because people are facing a bigger enemy, which is climate change. And it's a little bit cliche, but an enemy of an enemy is my friend. And when people's houses are burning down in wildfires, when people are running out of water because of droughts, when floods are destroying entire towns, and the science points to beavers as a potential way to reduce that threat, people want to work with the beavers then. They don't like that the beaver chews on their tree. They don't like that the beaver might flood their driveway, but they don't like wildfire more. So it's been very motivating. I would say in the last 10 years, we've seen a really big shift in public opinion on beavers. It was fairly like, I'm not a big fan. This is a weird animal. It's chaotic. It's hard to work with. To, wow, there's a lot of challenges in front of us. And how do I make a difference that affects the place I live? You can't just wait for some top-down change to happen. The pressure of fire and drought and flood is now. So what can I do? And what's great about beavers is they don't require permits. And so much of changing the environment and changing the land for humans rightfully requires permits. But beavers just show up and they will do it. They will build the wetland. They will build the ponds. They will store the water. They will slow the flows of floods. And they are doing it all for free. And they are doing it without having to submit a 25-page packet to the county administration.
These little guys seem endlessly inventive. I see why Emily is fascinated by them. In Hoppers, Mabel gets to jump into a robot beaver and speak to the creatures that occupy her pond and the land around it.
Yes, yes, this into this. This into this.
But what would Emily do if she could hop?
I would go talk to every other beaver I could find and ask them, why are you doing this? And what else are you doing? Because I can only see so much through my lens as a scientist with satellites or drones or doing field work. I know that every picture I get of beavers is through my lens, and I want to know what they're doing through their own lens. They put so much more effort into managing the landscape than any other animal. I think they're comparable to us in how much they want to control the places they live. And I want to know why. Do they care that other animals are coming to live in their wetland? Are they doing this to help them? Does it bother them that other animals are coming? A lot of the beaver dams that I walk across have mint and wildflowers growing out of them because the beavers are hauling all of these piles of mud that have seeds. Do they like that? Do they want it to be minty? Do they know that ponds are kind of stinky? And when they go through the mint, it's like getting a little bit of air freshener on them. I just want to know what they think of this because they create such an extraordinary change. They must have an opinion.
And one of the biggest changes they make, as Emily mentioned, can help slow or even stop the spread of wildfires. Fires that, with climate change, are becoming a far too regular occurrence.
Yeah, I've been affected by wildfires myself. I did my doctorate in Colorado, and my first professor job was in California, and my family still lives in Colorado. And fire was constantly around us, and so we were just aware of its presence. There's smoke issues every day. But I really confronted it quite personally in 2020. The pandemic had just kicked off. My parents were in Fort Collins. I wanted to go stay in town with them for that month. And a fire was burning just on the foothills. And from my condo's balcony, I could see walls of flame on the foothills nearby. And every day it was a question, is the wind going to blow this into town? You could go outside and put out your hand and it would look like a leaf was falling down. But when it hits your hand, it just turns into dust because it was actually like the ash carcass of the leaf. The weirdest and most poignant thing, I think, for that fire was there was a day when the smoke was so bad that you went outside in the middle of the day, you could see the sun like this red dot, but everything felt cold, like during a solar eclipse. There was that much stuff in the atmosphere. And seeing those leaves rain down and the pieces of pine cone raining down, I know what's blocking the sun is an ecosystem that was destroyed. That's the reality of fire, is we genuinely couldn't stop those fires. They started in late summer or early fall. Firefighting was not equipped to deal with them. You could hear the planes going constantly and the helicopters going constantly and no progress is being made. And we were so lucky that it snowed because all of the fires that were burning that year in Colorado were put out by snow, not by people, which makes you realize, like, geez, we need to work with nature because we're not strong enough alone to deal with this. And unfortunately, every year, more people in the United States feel that message and learn it themselves. Just this year, Nebraska, which is one of our Great Plains states, I think their current wildfire is about 1 million acres, and it's burning through everything. Everything is on fire. There's smoke everywhere. And every state that thinks, oh, this is a west of me problem, this is a different ecosystem problem, gets fires. And we just had fires here in Minnesota last year in spring that were wicked. And everyone in Minnesota was like, oh, geez, are we the next fire state? So I think people are seeing it in the media, feeling, oh, this is a problem, this is a climate change thing. But then once the fire actually comes to their home, it hits really hard. And they're like, this is a problem. This isn't normal. This is climate change. We got to do something.
Doing something that actively tackles our changing climate and all its impacts requires us to acknowledge the science behind it, something that's becoming increasingly hard under the current administration in America. Only last Friday, the Trump administration fired all members of the board overseeing the National Science Foundation with a single terse email. So it might feel hard to talk about the impact that an anti-science government can have.
No, it's fine. It's very challenging. I think we've had a lot of struggles with funding being cut across conservation sciences. We had a lot of federal support for the work that we were doing, and that has changed in the last couple of years. And more so than like, oh, my project doesn't have money on it anymore, we saw a huge reduction of jobs. And so in my own work, about half of my colleagues got fired. And when you lose them, you lose a lot of the momentum and the expertise that was keeping these projects going. So we are in a pretty tough spot. But I'll also add on to that, that the young people I'm working with and the very well-established people that have been let go of their jobs, they're still very passionate and they're trying to find any avenue to continue this work. So it's not that it's not happening. It's just that we all got shaken up and we're trying to get our bearings again so we can keep moving forwards.
The world needs more stories focused around the natural solutions that surround us and the brilliant people trying to give nature a helping hand. Hoppers is another huge step in the right direction, celebrating the marvels of a keystone species that influences so many other organisms in a balanced ecosystem. There is a darker way to tell this story, but, as Emily says, it's key to reach as many people as possible.
I think that it is most effective to get your story across when you make it as palatable as possible to the largest audience possible without losing the message. I would have loved personally to see a version of Hoppers that turned up the environmentalism to 11 and that leaned in even harder and that didn't shy away from the incredibly damaging things we do to the environment and our nonchalance towards it. But that would resonate with the percentage of the population that is already here supporting. And that's great. Sometimes we got to celebrate and be in community together. But for something like a Pixar movie that millions and millions, probably hundreds of millions of people are going to watch, this is an opportunity to show people gently something really important. And if you come in too strong, I think that you just trigger defensiveness and that's the end of that. And this is such an opportunity. Like, there's times and places to drill into the specifics and to lean into the fact that what we're doing is not right. And a Pixar movie is not the place to do that. A Pixar movie is the place to show the beauty of nature, the fantastic things that working with nature can do for us, the gentle lens of, yes, it is people making these decisions that have made that harder, but also we can change. If you present a story where nobody changes, then nobody who sees that will see a chance for themselves to change either.
Huge thanks to our Brain Trust for their input to this week's show. They'll feature again throughout the series. But we are so grateful to Emily for her time and the work she does with the University of Minnesota and the Beavers of America. To find out more, head to emilyfairfaxscience.com and head to the cinema to catch Hoppers. Sometimes it's hard to feel we can have as much impact as someone like Emily, but we can all feel a similar connection to nature and each other.
I would suggest to folks, if you're feeling disempowered, to do just like Mabel does and go sit in nature quietly, whatever nature you have, even if that means sitting on your porch in a city and just feeling the wind on you. Do that and remind yourself of how powerful nature is. The next time that there's a lot of wind, that's nature. If you see a lightning storm, that's also nature. When you see bugs come crawling out of the earth after being semi-frozen for 6 months because that's how they go through their life cycle, that's really cool and that's nature. It's really tough. And when we're in a fight that we are overpowered in, which is the fight against climate change, we are not winning this on our own. We need to have allies and friends that are more powerful than us, and that can be nature. But nature needs us to accept it. It's ready to be our partner. We just have to decide it's time.
Ecolution is produced by Nikki Coughlin with edit assistance from Austin Kenny. And it's presented by me, Evie Kenny.